Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hi, my name is Shane Terrio, and you are listening to The Riff Raff. Music, stories, and insights from the front line. Although he grew up in a small town just south of London, England, spend some time hanging out with John Cleary, and you will swear he must be the result of some sort of super engineering experiment that sought to combine the absolute best of New Orleans funk soul lineage into one person. It's in his DNA. From the way he plays to the subtle ways it permeates his native English accent. In addition to being a pianist and a guitarist of impeccable taste and feel, he's also a really gifted vocalist. Cleary, who has 8 solo records to date, recently won a Grammy last year for a record called Go-Go Juice, which I had the pleasure of working on, being a part of. He was also a member of Bonnie Raitt's band for 10 years. I think she once referred to him as the 9th wonder of the world. John frequently plays at the world-famous Maple Leaf Bar, a place that he's had a connection with since the early 80s. He also tours all over the world with his band, the Absolute Monster Gentleman. In this interview, we discuss piano, guitar styles, his early years, and his passion with finally making it to New Orleans, a place he really wanted to live. And you'll hear about the struggles and everything getting over here from England. We talk about James Booker. He's got some great stories about that legendary New Orleans pianist, Bonnie Raitt. And what makes the New Orleans sound unique to other styles, much, much more. We do a good bit of playing in this one, too. And this interview took place on a pretty hot day on June 2nd, 2017, at John's house and studio in New Orleans. And I'm just walking up to John's place now. He lives in a really funky old hardware store converted to his house with a studio, and it's a pretty amazing place. He's got R&B memorabilia everywhere and records and guitars. And I'm opening the door and I can hear piano, so I guess I'm in the right spot. And I hope you enjoy this one. All right, I'm sitting here in New Orleans with John Cleary.
In the heat.
In the heat. Love
it. Humidity.
Purging all our germs and things with the sweat. June 1st, man, it feels like August.
Well, we've been lucky. We actually had a spring this year in New Orleans. It's been really nice. And the air conditioners, normally at this stage in the year, would have been on for a month already, but they've been on for a week. So we had 3 weeks grace, but now it's coming on fast.
Well, look, thanks for doing this short notice.
I know
you up at like midnight or something. And, yeah. Hey, by the way, can I come by? But, you know, I've been thinking about trying to get you on, and since we have a working relationship of some sorts over the years.
Yeah.
And, man, always loved your playing. And
you know, well, feeling is mutual there, you know that.
Thanks, John. I remember the first time I met you, it just came to me. It was in Australia.
Was it really?
Byron Bay Blues Fest.
Were you there with the Neville Brothers?
I was with the Nevilles. I was walking around with Nick Daniels.
Oh, I remember that, Willie Green.
We
I remember that, yeah.
The street, and you pulled up in a car and just got out. And he's like, John. And that's where, yeah.
I do remember that. I think I was as surprised as you. I thought, hang about. Looks like some cats from New Orleans.
Yeah, exactly. Causing trouble walking around looking like
a group. At a time when you didn't really see many New Orleans musicians in Australia.
Man, I wish the listeners could see your place, because I came here, I don't know how long you had been here at that point. I came over here one day and you were here with Tony Bronigo, and I think Eric Burden was here.
Yeah.
And you had just put the studio together.
That's right, I remember you coming round, yeah. Well, it's a work in progress, really, but it's a funky old hardware store from the late 19th century. Pretty crude construction, as they all were back in those days. They used to basically tamp down the swamp and then put oyster shells.
Wow.
Down and tamp them down, and they would pour concrete squares on top of that, and then they would build a timber framed house. It's quite big. The walls of these old houses are made out of barge board. That's the board that they used to make barges from, that floated goods down the Mississippi River in the days before steam travel. And so a lot of the houses here in New Orleans close to the river are built out of old boats. But it's right on the ground. It's been raining for 4 days, so it's very humid, very musty smelling.
I love it. Yeah. Feels good.
It's the swamps.
Feels like home.
Yeah. So it's funky. It's very funky.
It's funky. But this was a hardware store, right? And wasn't it boarded up for like 50 years or something?
I think it closed in the 1950s. My old neighbors can remember coming here when they were kids.
Yeah.
And there was an old man that... sat, and he was surrounded by piles and piles. Apparently it was complete chaos. Nothing much has changed. But we still have a lot of the old shelves and drawers and store furniture that got left here. So
it suits you, man. It's got a vibe.
I seem to live in... I always live in stores. Before this, I lived in an old grocery store. So from a grocery store to a hardware store. But it's fine. Yeah, it's got a lot of character. It's funky.
Sure.
A few hundred yards from the Mississippi River, and it's a part of town called the Ninth Ward. Old part of New Orleans. Fats Domino used to live a few blocks over the other side of the canal. A lot of good musicians came from this part of New Orleans. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, a lot of people know you as a great pianist, you know, which you are. You sound like you're born and raised in New Orleans, man. But you're also a great guitar player, too, and I want to focus on that later.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people don't realize you started out on guitar.
I started playing guitar really little, yeah, because all the grown-ups in my family played guitar. And that's what I thought you did when you were a grown-up. So I'm like, well, kids, you want to grow up as quickly as possible. So it's like, show me how to do it. I want to do that. And my hands are too little to get around the neck, but they would show me. They were, you know, they were very encouraging. I had lots of good teachers. I had three uncles that were musicians, and my dad played, and three grandparents that were musicians. So it was a very obvious thing to do, you know, but guitar, really. And then my mum's passion is still old New Orleans jazz. And she's where that influence in the family comes from. She was a teenager in the 50s when a wave of young English musicians were first able to get hold of old New Orleans 78s. So there were bands, guys like Chris Barber.
Yeah.
People that she used to go and see. And so... I always was familiar with New Orleans jazz, but it was New Orleans piano that at some point just set all my light bulbs flashing brightly. And that's, we had a piano, my grandma's old piano in the house. And so it was that, you know, the riff.
Yep.
That's what I really dug. And I was hearing it on different records without realizing, without making the New Orleans association. And I think I just was naturally hardwired for playing New Orleans funk, because that I dug the hell out of it before I even knew it came from New Orleans. But that whole, you know. Which in New Orleans we call funk.
Papadou or whatever. Yeah. All those songs.
Man. Yeah. In New Orleans, that's called funk. Funk elsewhere means Sly Stone or Bootsy Collins or George Clinton.
Right.
Funk is in New Orleans.
Funk is, it's
an attitude to playing.
The straight mixed with the swing. Almost.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that graceful thing with the guitar chords and with the human voice and with saxophones with reeds and brass instruments, you can bend notes, the human voice. But what's great with the piano is that you have this challenge. You can't bend the string, so you have to get inventive with mixing up the minor thirds and the major thirds. And I love all that with the sustain pedal. Then you let those notes ring. So usually with a lot of instruments, you have one note at a time, and you transition from a minor third to a major third, and you do that thing of creating that ambiguity. With a piano, you've got all that attention. Mysterious, yeah. Sexy, mysterious. It's like a monster crawling out of the swamp. I love all that shit. So.
Yeah.
So that, when I first got a little taste of that, then the guitar was on the side. It's been really on the side ever since.
Certain things don't translate well, you know. I mean, I could play those notes on the guitar, and it wouldn't sound as it wouldn't come across the same. It wouldn't translate the same.
No, every instrument is suited to or demands a unique approach, and guitar certainly is a perfect vehicle for playing the same trick but doing it in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So it's nice to be able to play both of them, but I just made a conscious decision to put the guitar on the side for a little while. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you move from a guitar to a piano, suddenly it's like being led out of a garden into an enormous field to go and romp in, because you've got this huge, big noise that you can make. And, you know, from there to there. And what's so hip for me is because I always dug percussion. I was like, and piano is a percussion instrument. And the New Orleans stuff especially really plays with the percussive aspect, because you get all that great funky. With all the chords, mm-hmm. and you get nice big arpeggios, mm-hmm. you can play, but it's the syncopated funk thing.
It's a whole orchestra there.
Yeah, and of course Professor Longhair and Jelly Roll Morton.
Maybe we could demonstrate something. I don't know, just off the top of my head. If I play something. Thank you. Those little voicings you're playing, what makes that New Orleans to you? I mean, you know, little things like these little cliches, like you were doing, you know, those little piano rolls and these things. That's like sort of a New Orleans thing. You know, those kind of things.
That, yeah.
You know, there's a lot of these things exist in places other than New Orleans, and of course, with millions of people. Beavering away with the same instruments, the same four beats in a bar, the same 12 notes for the last 100 years on the same instruments. It's very rarely that you'll ever find one thing that exists in like a vacuum. You know, everything's influenced by everything else.
But those things really sound New Orleans.
There are certain things. I think this, the way you play those, those little trills. Those. The way you slur the notes.
Is that a Booker or a Fest thing?
All of them, really. I mean, it probably goes back to guys that weren't even ever recorded, that we know, you know, we just know their names, guys like Tony Jackson, you know. But there are lots of elements that make New Orleans music New Orleans. But, you know, at the same token, there are people who never thought like that and didn't really care one way or the other, didn't try and play New Orleans. They just happen to be from here, and they heard a lot of the same influences. And so they come up doing something that they do. And then, you know, when you look back over the period of several decades, you can see, well, that guy actually contributed something new. He wasn't trying to sound like New Orleans. Mm. And the all the great piano players that we know about in the last 100 years who were recorded, you know, often would be quite dismissive of what had gone before. They didn't really care that much. I mean, they would have seen old guys when they were coming up. That's all they had access to, because this is in the days before YouTube and the internet. Even before records, you know, going back away. So you know that Professor Longhair used to paint on a little false moustache and go and see Toots Washington when he was underage. I don't suppose that Professor Longhair could have even named a Jelly Roll Morton tune if you asked him. And I'm sure that James Booker admired Fess because he was one of the old cats when he was coming up. And he could emulate Fess, and the same as Alan Toussaint could. But they didn't really, I don't suppose he owned any Professor Longhair records. If he saw Fess, he would be happy to see him. But, you know, I think in a way I've got this kind of European idolatry of all these guys, which is great. And when you live here, of course, you take it for granted too. But the point is that it's not an academic experiment, the way this music evolves, has evolved. And musicians from here generally don't really care.
No, it's
they just want to go out and play the music, and they heard a bunch of old guys when they were coming up, and that's kind of influenced them. But they like what's on the radio, and they just do what they do. It's not an academic thing. Music in New Orleans is part of the social glue.
Sort of osmosis. People.
And funk is the ethnic folk music of New Orleans. The way you break down the four beats of a bar, and the way you play with the blue notes, and the way you break the rules, that's something that they invented here. It's only because it was so good that it got exported all around the world that it's familiar to many people. Most people don't realize this is funk and jazz. This is the ethnic folk music of New Orleans. Same way as throat singing is the ethnic folk music of the Tuvans. And
business.
It's just that here and where we are now is so good that it got exported and embraced first of all in St. Louis and New York and Chicago, and then it got exported to Europe and all over the world. First with New Orleans jazz and then with rhythm and blues. Well, that's what everyone else calls rock and roll. They just call it rhythm and blues here.
So Earl Palmer took those grooves and brought them to L.A. and made them sort of mainstream radio back in the 50s.
Yeah, and here in New Orleans, with Cosmo Studio with Little Richard, Lee Allen, all those guys. So there are certain things that are particularly New Orleansy. But the funny thing is, New Orleans was always a horn town and a drummer's town and a piano town. And it wasn't really a place that's associated with guitar players in the same way as you associate Texas with blues guitarists or Mississippi
really
or
like that. Yeah,
Chicago or whatever. But even the guitar players from New Orleans, to my mind, always played like piano players. Lonnie Johnson was the first guy to bend strings. He's from New Orleans. I used to play with Snooks Eaglin. He played.
Yeah, he was great.
He played a lot of stuff like a piano player. Walter Washington would voice chords like a piano player.
Yeah.
Even Earl King used to do that sort of the minor third and the major, the suspended thing. That sounded like a. It was like that.
Yeah, those little things like Leo Nocentelli would do some, those little sus things, you know, that's some New Orleansy kind of, you wouldn't think that, but I've never heard anybody else do those sort of things.
Yeah.
I mean, Cornell Dupree is a guitar player that sort of sounds, he's from Texas, kind of sounds like some Louisiana thing. You know, it's like you said, it's all the same thing. But the reason I brought it up is because there's definite sort of cliches that show up in, even today, even with the modern bands that come out of New Orleans, you hear with Shorty or Trouble Shorty or whatever, you'll hear some of those little things. When you started out playing guitar, I know we spent a lot of time talking about piano, but I want to talk about when we were doing your record, Go-Go Juice, there was a tune called Boneyard, and you sent me the demos, and it had this really happening guitar part intro, which I copped. Mm-hmm. I think I did it in a wrong position. I don't know, but it ended up working with what you did, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And I said, man, where did you get this riff? And you said your uncle.
Did your uncle, that's Uncle John's riff, yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I can't. Can you play it? I want to get
sure.
Because I don't remember it. I'd have to.
I remember him playing this. He lived in New Orleans when I was a little kid. And this just to send me letters and stuff. And then when he left New Orleans, he couldn't bear the thought of going straight back to England. So he went to Ireland, and when he got to Ireland, he headed all the way to the south of Ireland and then got on a ferry and went to a little island off the coast of Ireland called Sherkin, and which at the time was a popular place for the new sort of hippie generation that were rediscovering their Celtic roots, so they're playing traditional Irish stuff. And so he had a real passion for Irish music, and then when I was a little kid, he would show me stuff. And to me, this riff was always like a sort of a Celtic version of a Professor Longhair riff.
Yeah, okay.
That's what it kind of sounded like. It sounded like a bit like an Irish jig or a reel. But at the same time, it was funky, in the same way as, you know, it was funky. And so I would just watch him play, and I would just memorize, just watch his fingers, he plays.
Listened to that this morning on the way over here so I could sort of refresh, and it sounds like you maybe kept the part I did with your part when you mixed the record.
And there's a third guitar, and that's him.
Wow, he played on it too.
Yeah, he was
over
there. He came over to you. He was visiting New Orleans. Hey, come check this out.
How cool is that?
And I said, I want you to play on it. So it wasn't the guitar that was comfortable to him, but I blended the three of them. So it's you, me, and him playing that riff together.
That's great.
Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna have had some fun. Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna get some loving on. Before I'm nothing but skull and bones, gonna get on my mouse like a rolling stone. Before I make it to the boneyard, I'm gonna have my fun. Oh, nah, ain't ready for the boneyard, ain't ready for the boneyard. Ain't ready for the boneyard.
But I want to talk about, because man, we could spend way more time talking about history. It's like, so it'll be nonstop. But I want to focus on some stories, if you could, because I know you were at the Maple Leaf during the Booker times. I mean, is there like a cool story you could share? Like a
I think I've probably forgotten most of them because it was so long ago. But it seemed like there was a story every day with Booker. I mean, it's a shame, really, because the anecdotal stuff about Booker is always kind of sad because he was a pretty messed up character, really. But it's often quite funny as well. I was there the night, back then, the biggest band on the bar scene in New Orleans was the Radiators. And they would play once a month, they would play at the Maple Leaf. And that was a time in the early 80s when New Orleans was a real boom town. Oil money was flying everywhere. And the bars, there'd be a sort of sense of anticipation on Saturday afternoon as they were getting ready for the big night because they knew the place would be packed and it would go on till like 6 or 7 or 8 o'clock the following morning. So the big thing was to stock as many beers in the cooler as they could possibly fit. And so it was a military operation. They'd clean everything out, they'd get all the ice, they'd get all the beers, everything would be stocked up and they'd cover it all with a layer of ice. And just as they were getting, just as it completed, I was sitting at the bar next to Booker. And he just suddenly went,
God.
And then he looked over and he threw up in the icebox. Booker was a terrible junkie and he was throwing up. But he threw up in the icebox and they had to take everything out and do it all over again.
Oh, my God.
I remember that one. He used to stay upstairs and I had a job painting the bar and he would come out and I'd be up there on the balcony on a step ladder with a gallon of paint. My deal at the Maple Leaf, the owner of the bar gave me a job, and the deal was I got free drink while I worked. Me and my mate, we were like 17 years old, fresh off the boat from England, free drink while we worked. We could work whatever hours
like
we wanted.
Daiquiri drive-through.
Yeah, yeah, and we got half-price drink at any other time, and got to see all the bands free.
Drinks while you work.
So we'd make up our own hours. So we'd start work at 3 in the afternoon when the hangovers were abating, and we'd go in and make our own cocktails behind the bar. So I'd be on a ladder with a gallon of paint, a big spliff, a bag of crisps, a Dixie beer, balancing it, trying to paint at the same time with the radio, listening to early OZ. And then the door would open, it was Booker trying to come out of the apartment, and he'd always be cursing, get that fucking ladder out of the way. So I'd have to come down with all this stuff, move it just so Booker could get out and could come back in again.
Oh.
Yeah, it was funny.
Let me ask you this. Mm. What, you know, for those of you listening, James Booker, he's famous for wearing this. He's iconic character with the star patch, you know. I've heard from people we know, like very legendary New Orleans musicians, differing stories and accounts of how he got the patch and what was the reason. I've heard Ringo Starr, which is, you know, his bodyguards kicked him. He owed money. I've heard, what else? CIA. You know,
wish I knew. I never asked him, and I wish I had asked him. I don't think anybody knows, and everybody's got a different story.
Yeah.
Everybody's got a different story. I know he had two eyes once, and he disappeared, and he went on bender for a couple of weeks, and by the time he resurfaced, he had one eye, and no one knows what happened in the meantime, how that happened. So who knows? And he was a gay, black, one-eyed junkie, madman, who was schizophrenic. I'd see him some days and he'd be really chatty and friendly. Because I was in there all the time, and he'd be in there all the time because he got free drink too. So he'd be in there hanging out, just playing the piano while I was painting outside. So I saw him all the time. And sometimes he'd be friendly, other times it was like he'd never seen me before.
Yeah,
you never knew what you were going to get, really. And his shows were very erratic. He played every Tuesday, and I saw him every Tuesday for a couple of years. So I must have seen 100 James Booker gigs. And sometimes it was brilliant. I can remember other times walking up and thinking, oh, God, it's Booker again. Let's go somewhere else. And it sounds amazing to say that, but it inconsistent. Depends on what cocktails of
just exactly
heroin and Crown 7
they're
were going through.
They're in altered states, and the genius gets suppressed, or sometimes it maybe enhances it, unfortunately.
Well, if the cocktails were right, if the combination of everything was right, then it would enhance it, and it was like a performance-enhancing drug. You would do this superhuman stuff, elevated to levels of inspiration. You'd play stuff that was amazing. But yeah, the heroin, I think, for him was a performance-enhancing drug when it worked. It was the other way around when it wasn't working. Or if you caught him an hour too late or an hour too soon.
Yeah, Mac told me that he had one time, he said, yeah, I had Booker and James Black in my band at the same time. He goes, oh, God, that was a headache. He said, I walked in the room one day and James is with his midget in the room and all kinds of crazy stuff that I can't repeat. You started out, you became a session musician in London, is that right? You
no.
were doing, or was that later? Or was that ever?
No, never. I never really was as much of a session musician in England, really. I mean, I left England after as soon as I was old enough to get out of school. I got out of school when I was 17 and got a job as a labourer on a construction site carrying sheetrock up and down.
Wow.
Six flights
of stairs.
That's
a lot more interesting. I know you from here, so I know the story, the maple leaf and painting and
yeah,
all
well,
that
I did,
stuff.
I saved up. The idea was to get to New Orleans as quickly as possible. I was broke, so I got a job. My grandma got me a job for 6 months on the building site, and I failed completely at saving any money. My grandma got me a job with her next-door neighbor, who was the foreman of a construction site in London, and there was a job going for anybody stupid enough to get up at the crack of dawn and spend an entire day carrying sheetrock, two sheets of sheetrock at a time, up and down six flights of stairs, day in and day out for 6 months. I did that.
Serious work.
I did that. And I suppose that the idea was to save the money to come to New Orleans. I didn't save hardly anything. And but I did come to New Orleans. But I arrived with about $100.
Wow.
And it could so easily have gone so horribly wrong, but everything went right, and I was really lucky. And I was relying on the kindness of strangers, and I just landed on my feet. It was a combination of luck and the good people of New Orleans, who I think looked at me and thought, who is this idiot? What does he think he's doing? I mean, I didn't know anybody. I mean, I knew the name of a girl that worked behind the bar at the Maple Leaf, because she was a distant association of someone from England. So I went straight to the Maple Leaf and was offered somewhere to stay and got a job at the Leaf, got a job at the bar, and got to see all the bands for free and got to see James Booker every Tuesday night. Mm. And then occasionally when Booker didn't show up, they'd get me up on the piano because they learned that I could play a couple of tunes. I was in heaven. So that was it. I never went back. Well, I did go back at one point because I got kicked out of the country for overstaying my visa. and then I made my way back in surreptitiously by hook or by crook. And but that was over a third of a century ago, so I've been here a long time now.
Yeah, man. You're part of the fiber of this city for sure.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm very lucky that I knew what I wanted to do. I mean, I really knew what I wanted to do, and I was very lucky that I was able to do it, and I'm still here enjoying it.
You ain't got to beg, steal, or borrow, my love. You ain't got to beg, steal, or borrow, my love.
Working at the Maple Leaf, you just started putting your own band together, right? At some point, you started working with Walter Wolfman, right?
Well, I was always the world. I was just desperate to play. I really wanted to play. I mean, that's the reason I came to New Orleans, was for the music. And I was going out hearing amazing music every night. And when I look back, I appreciated it because I was coming from England and from a little village in the countryside, you know. On my first night in New Orleans, the night I arrived, I saw Earl King playing. The following afternoon, I saw Sonny Terry and Brownie McGhee playing at Jed's across the street in the afternoon. I mean, I saw amazing music from the get-go. But I was no good at hustling, really. And I don't like, generally, I don't like it when people come and ask if they can sit in or sit in and play. You know, you've got to pay your dues and wait for the right moment. And so the house I moved into had an old upright piano. I was really interested in the piano at that point. I wanted to find out where Mac Rebernack got all his amazing phrases and feel, where he got his ideas from. And so it was ironic that because he was my entree into New Orleans piano player. I'd heard him as a sideman on records and loved what he did. And I spent the first part of my career trying to sound exactly like Dr. John the piano. I spent the last half desperately trying to not to sound like him.
A lot of people never get to the second half.
Out of respect for him, you know. But so I got to shed on the piano every night when I went home, and I got to listen to a lot of music. And I spent 2 years basically just listening and playing for hours at home. And I got a few opportunities here and there to play. But one night when Booker didn't show up, they got me up to play piano. So that was my first piano gig. And then I had to leave the country. And then when I left, I went back to England. I didn't want to go, but I had to. And at that point, my hustle factor kicked up into high gear. And so I put a band together in London and went around all the pubs and hustled gigs. And I was just full to the brim of New Orleans adrenaline enthusiasm. I was just 100% New Orleans. And I just was, you know, I didn't want to be in England particularly. I would have just stayed in New Orleans if I could, but I couldn't. And so I put together bands from the best musicians I could find, guys who were like 20 years older than me, mostly. And there weren't very many. There were some good players. They're really good players. Not many people that are particularly familiar with the New Orleans thing. So it was always an approximation. And I did that for about a year and a half, playing around all the pubs and learning how to plug in a PA system and how to put a band together, how to hustle a gig, how to get paid at the end of the night. And I made a living from doing that. And I played every night. I had gigs every night. And it got my chops up. And I started writing, and you know, I did a few little sessions here and there, but not very much. I was still a kid. I was about 21, 22, and I came back to New Orleans. I just decided I was going back. And at that point, I started hustling in New Orleans. Oh. So I got Professor Longhair's old gig at Tipitina's on Monday nights. I got Booker's old gig at the Maple Leaf. He had died while I was back in England. And I got Archibald's old gig at the Absinthe Bar in the daytime. And I started getting hired to play with Sam McClain and then Walter Washington. And then I was in Johnny Adams' bag. I got hired to play behind Johnny Adams. And then Earl King and Snooks Eaglin.
Wow, man.
And
legends.
And Tommy Ridgely and all these names that probably don't mean much to a lot of people, but if you're an aficionado of New Orleans R&B, they're enormous, enormously important. Absolutely. Irving Charles and Smokey Johnson, that was my band at one point. The Fats Domino's rhythm section. I'm doing gigs with George Porter from the Meters and having Red Tyler on saxophone, David Lasty. And, you know, all the old R&B guys were still alive and they all needed gigs. And I was one of the few cats that actually knew all the solos on the original records. So Earl King would hire me because I knew how to play the piano parts, solo, the Huey Piano Smith kind of stuff, and Toots Washington stuff. And so I was just, and that's what I did. I had to keep my head under the radar because I wasn't really supposed to be in New Orleans.
You're sort of, it's a similar when you're talking, I'm listening to, because I asked Mac one time, I was like, how did you find yourself in the favorable position to be in Los Angeles in the late 60s, you know, right in the middle of the Wrecking Crew, and he's like, I got paroled there. Yeah. I didn't want to go. It just happened. He didn't want to go. But, you know, it's sort of the same thing with you. You had to go back to England, but it was an advantage because you got really...
It worked, yes. You got recharged. In retrospect, it was a good thing, really. And so, you know, that's what I did for years. I mean, very under the radar here in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. And New Orleans is not what I would consider. I mean, having lived in L.A. and Nashville and these music towns, New Orleans is a music city, but it's not really a hustle business town.
No, I would, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. Like, you really don't get anything accomplished when
no
you try
business
to
gets done here at all. Yeah. No, but it was a great place to learn how to play music that has a certain personality and a certain attitude, and every note is imbued with that. Can learn a lot of stuff from records, but I think to play New Orleans music right, you have to live in New Orleans for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. I don't think you have to be born in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And ironically, a lot of the musicians that are associated with New Orleans weren't actually born in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. It's like Lee Allen and Lee Dorsey. Professor Longhead was born in Bogalusa. Mm-hmm. That's a long way away from New Orleans. But you've got to spend your formative years here. Mm-hmm. And that informs your approach to playing. And I think the music of New Orleans is a musical representation of so many things that make this city distinctive, from the food to the wrought iron balconies and the French Quarter to the humidity and the climate. Historically, the sort of the very laissez-faire attitude that existed here, this being a Caribbean port city and a Catholic city, importantly, where for a lot of people, the interpretation of Catholicism for them was permission from upon high to go and get up to all sorts of nefarious mischief, as long as you went to church on Sunday. So a lot of people go, you know, they used to say in New Orleans that every corner was either a saloon bar or a church. Yeah. And that people would crawl from one to the other on Sunday mornings for absolution, and then they got a clear check to go and do it all again the next week.
Oh, yeah. That slate's clean. You can do it all over again.
And there was that thing. And I mean, I could talk all day about New Orleans. I have a love affair in New Orleans. It's chaos. It's a dysfunctional city. And with the, as someone told me on my first day in New Orleans, that this place has the best politicians money can buy.
Yeah. In another way, I've heard, New York and New Orleans, the only two places I've ever, like, I've been there and I couldn't wait to leave. But then once I'm gone, I can't wait to go back.
Oh,
as soon
yeah.
as I'm on the plane, it's like, I'm ready to go back.
Yeah.
I remember the Neville brothers, they wouldn't even take, when we were in Australia or we'd be in Europe or whatever, they would never, Art and Aaron Neville would never take their watch off of New Orleans time.
Really?
Never. Tour manager would be like, what are you guys doing? Like, you know, we're 6 hours ahead. We're 13 hours. Nope. It's 6 o'clock in New Orleans. Like, wow. That's commitment, man. But that's what makes this city, as you're saying, you know, people.
Well, it's a blessing if you can live in this lovely little city and then but still get out on a regular basis because it is provincial. It's a great place to live for me. Yeah.
You also got out of here on a tour with, or a long relationship with Bonnie Raitt, and that enabled you to get out of the New Orleans touring thing.
Well, the first tour I ever did in the States was with Walter. Little tours around Southwest Louisiana and Texas and Mississippi with Johnny Adams and Sam McClain, the blues guys, you know, playing these little black clubs, and then and then I got an offer to work with Taj Mahal. So that was my first time in Los Angeles in a studio making a record. And through Taj, I met Bonnie Raitt. And then I joined, after a couple of years with Taj, I joined Bonnie's band.
Now, how did you get that? You knew them through your Taj.
I was on a
connection.
Session. I was doing a recording session with Taj. Taj wanted to do a couple of my songs that the producer, John Porter, had played him. And this time I was sort of in exile in London. And I got a call saying, Taj really digs these songs. Is it okay if he does them on the record? And it's like, are you kidding me? He's one of my favorites. I've loved Taj since I was about 10 years old. love Taj Mahal. And then I got a call saying, he wants you to come play on the record. And I said, well, I'd love to, but I can't because I need a visa for that. And they said, well, let's see what we can do. And they hooked me up with a visa for 2 weeks to come in and work on a Taj record. So I did the Taj record, and Bonnie was a guest on the record. And I talked with Taj, and I met Bonnie again when I was playing with Taj on the blues cruise. She came in and sat in with us. She flew, and we were docked in St. Croix, the festival. So she came and played, Bonnie and Charles Brown, and Taj's band. So I met her then, and then I met her again when I was on a gig with B.B. King in L.A. And at that point, she said, hey, look, I need a piano player. You want to come join my band? So I said no, because I couldn't. I just got a record deal, my first record deal. I was making my first record, and I was in the middle of it. I said, boy, I'd kill to come join your band, but I have an obligation to make this record.
Reason, sure.
And so I said I couldn't do it, and I was, I just was honest, I couldn't do it. I had to make a record. And the record company got wind of it, and they called me up and said, you idiot, call her back immediately and say you'll do it, and we'll get the record made some kind of way. So I rang her up and said, is the job still open? She said, yeah, okay. So that's how I joined Bonnie's band. Bad mistake, a crying shame. Get caught playing a damn fool's game. Bad mistake is a crying shame. Get caught playing a damn fool's game.
I thought it was through Hutch used to live here in the 80s, right? Hutch Hutchison, the bass player.
I used to see Hutch playing with the Neville Brothers, but I never knew him.
Okay. I didn't know if you guys knew each other back then.
No.
Yeah. And you mentioned John Porter. I know he's a dear friend of yours, and he became a friend of mine and my wife, and I miss the guy. He moved back to England. But
John Porter's a musician from England who became a producer. I have a frustration on recording sessions when no one seemed to really be taking charge of getting the record made. So by default, he ended up becoming a record producer. And I met him at a party when he was living in Los Angeles. And we hit it off. And we've been good friends ever since, over 20 years now. But he's produced all of my records.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And he's marvelous. Good player, and really good record producer.
I love working with John. I mean, you and I worked together on a few things with him producing, quite a few things. But I remember the Ricky Lee Jones one. Everybody remembers that one. Well, that was fun. But
we did Tommy Malone, I think, and a few other projects. Yeah.
I love being in the studio with you because you're very creative. I mean, you have the New Orleans feel, but you know harmonically how to shape things and craft it towards a singer-songwriter that might not necessarily be vintage New Orleans R&B or what have you.
Yeah, well, I think I think it's good to... I mean, it's funny, I speak with an English accent, despite the fact I've lived here for so long, but I play piano with a New Orleans accent. You know, if you like making records and you aspire to working as a session musician, you need to learn more. You need to have a few tricks up your sleeve, you know. So it's good to be able to play in different styles. And you do that anyway, you know. You can't just play New Orleans piano. You have to play other styles in order to play New Orleans piano.
Right.
You have to have an understanding of how it's all put together, what the laws of music are.
Maybe we could just play something. Or
sure.
I don't know. Let's see. Thank you.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, I love playing with you because you've been from New Orleans. You know how to play guitar with piano players. That when I used to play in Mac's band, that was I think the way he dug too, being a you've got to be able to play. New Orleans is not R&B is not associated with guitars, as we said earlier on, but there's definitely a right way and a wrong way of playing guitar with New Orleans R&B. And it's great to hear someone from New Orleans doing
man.
It right.
I just try to stay out of the way.
Well, it's the funk. It's getting the funk right.
Let me ask you this, John. Because you were there, you know, when you go to Jazz Fest, you see people wearing T-shirts. They have James Booker. They have Fess. You know, it's Fess heads and everything, you know, meters. Like, we know, like, do you think that was the peak of New Orleans music? Or, I mean, what's your opinion now versus then? I mean, I don't want to ruminate on the past, but you're one of the few guys that are, like, continuing to do, in my opinion, fresh things with the New Orleans sound, you know, rather than just play the same repertoire.
I don't like the retro thing. I think we're in danger sometimes now that all the old catalogs are available. Anything's ever been recorded, you can find in seconds on YouTube now. And in a way, it's unfair because I think young musicians are now competing with every musician ever recorded in the last 100 years.
Yeah. I never thought of that.
And there's only 12 notes. There's only 4 beats unless you want to start getting really out. Most listeners don't like that. They want to have something they can digest. So you're a working musician. You're selling your tickets to your gigs and selling records. So you got to do stuff that people want to do. Without resorting to kind of novelty. And when you're just dealing with the music, you know, if you're going to, it's important you do something new, but it's increasingly difficult. And everything is derivative. I don't think I'd be interested in a piece of music that wasn't derivative of something. I think music is has a linear evolution. There's tradition, very important. Mm-hmm. It's very important in New Orleans. As to the status of music in New Orleans right now, it's impossible to say. I think in 50 years you could look back and you say, wow, that was a real golden era. I do think I probably am like most people. I think I'm my vessel isn't big enough to fully appreciate everything, all the beauty of all, you know, of everything that's around while it's around. With nostalgic, rose-tinted spectacles, you can look back
human
and see.
Nature. Yeah,
you can see all this amazing stuff that I was surrounded by when I was a teenager here in New Orleans. I could go. I saw Stevie Ray Vaughan used to play in the bar across the street, and if I could be bothered to walk 100 yards, I could go over and see him playing for $5 to about 10 people. It was amazing music. Clifton Chenier would play regularly. Amazing stuff. And I knew it was amazing, but reality was normal. That was normal here in New Orleans then. And you assimilate and you recalibrate and you adjust. And so that was normal. It wasn't a big deal. I mean, it's an enormously big deal when I describe it to people and when I look back. It seems now that all those people are gone, that whole generation of New Orleans musicians are not around anymore. And so I really miss them. I miss Jesse Hill and Ernie Cader. And I miss Red Tyler and Earl Palmer. And I could go on and on and on for hours naming all the names of the people that used to be around that weren't a big deal. They were playing in little clubs around town. Mm-hmm. I don't know that tastes in music are such, or the music business is such, that the young people coming up in the black culture of New Orleans able to produce music in the kind of context that really, a little petri dish for that stuff half a century ago. The bar rooms aren't around anymore. The bar scene isn't around. It's dangerous in New Orleans. Ironically, bounce music it came out of New Orleans, and most people who are New Orleans music lovers probably don't even know what bounce is. Wouldn't particularly like it. Yeah. But it's actually arguably probably sold more records than any of New Orleans jazz or New Orleans rhythm and blues
probably
did in the
so.
Last century.
Yeah. Right, I never thought of that.
But as far as like a contemporary New Orleans sound, a lot of musicians here now, you'll find it awesome. They're from elsewhere. They've moved to New Orleans because they love it.
Yeah.
And they'll have some New Orleans. They'll have done some homework and learned some New Orleans stuff. But a lot of the bands that are playing here, to my mind, don't really sound very New Orleansy necessarily. Not that no reason why they should. But there was a New Orleans sound in the 50s, and there was a New Orleans sound when I got here. I think I got here at the tail end of it, really. But, you know, it's New Orleans, man. It's always people come. People that are born here are funky by disposition because it's in the genes. Mm-hmm. People that move here are funky by choice. A lot of people come to New Orleans and don't like it, and then they leave and they don't want to come back, and that's cool. A lot of other people get off the plane and go, oh, boy. And that's how I was. To me, New Orleans was like putting on an old comfortable
either
jacket.
Either you do or you don't. Yeah. And sometimes it wears off after a while, but it's always in your blood.
People that come here and stay are the ones that like the food, they like the music, they like the attitude, the way of life. Mm-hmm. And so that's what makes New Orleans unique in the United States. And so there'll always be music here. There'll always be good music, good time music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, music is the soundtrack to your social life.
Hey man, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Always great to play together. I look forward to hearing your new record, man.
Thank you. Yeah. It's going to be funky.
All right.
Well, there you have it. I hope you enjoyed that interview with John. It's a lot of fun to do. If this is the first time you've listened to Riff Raff, I really appreciate it and welcome. Thanks for stopping by. If you've made it this far, I really definitely appreciate it. I have a lot of other episodes up, if you haven't noticed. I have, there's Will Lee, Warren DeMartini, Weasel Zappa, John Schofield, Mike Stern, some other New Orleans greats, Johnny Vidakovich, George Porter Jr. from the Meters, and I'm working on a bunch of them. I'm doing this right now while I'm on tour with Hall & Oates editing, and it takes a lot of work, so only thing I ask is if you'll go and leave me a good review on iTunes if you like it. It helps it move up in the charts there, and I love hearing comments about it. Don't ask for any money. It's just a little joy to do this. I would like to say, though, I do have a new solo record out if you like the New Orleans sound. It's called Still Motion. It's a bunch of different trios with myself and Jim Keltner and John Vidakovich, James Singleton, Kirk Covington, some other great players. Check it out if you like it. I appreciate it. Take care. See you next time.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.